In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye.
And welcome. Today is a very special show. It is our 15th annual 4th of July show. It's not the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration yet, but it is the 250th of the start of the Revolution. To understand July 4th, 1776, it's important to know what happened in 1775, the year leading up to it. Next year, of course, will be the huge 250th of 1776, but this year there are already a lot of 250s from 1775. Back on April 19th, it was the 250th of Lexington and Concord. On June 17th, it was the 250th of Bunker Hill, and there were other events and some more battles yet to come in 1775, all leading up to the Declaration of Independence. 1775 set the stage for the colonies to finally declare themselves independent. To talk about that, I'd like to welcome our annual guest for these shows, Greg Leo. He is a government and public affairs consultant for tribes, businesses, and individuals. If you're struggling with something that the legislature is trying to do to you or to your business, and you'd like to get some help, Greg is your man. He's an amateur historian and member of the Sons of American Revolution. Greg, thanks for joining us today. I'm really looking forward to this. I absolutely love this period of history.
Mark, thank you. And it is so important and so exciting to see the 250th anniversary coming up and understanding the roots of our American Republic.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's hard to condense an entire year as momentous as 1775 into a single hour, but we're going to try here. Especially since in talking about 1775, you actually even have to talk about some of the events before that. But today, our main focus is going to be the Battle of Lexington and Concord, because that was the match that finally lit the fuse for realsies at that point. We'll get into some of the people and events surrounding Lexington and Concord, as well as the aftermath, I hope. But before we get to it, let's back up just a bit further to look at what led to that fateful day and why it happened. Although it's earlier than 1775, perhaps the biggest event, I think, that led to that was the Boston Tea Party. And that happened in December of 1773. 46 tons of tea were destroyed. And as a result of that, 4,000 troops were dispatched to Boston in the spring of 1774. Parliament also passed a series of measures known in Britain as the Coercive Acts. And in the colonies, they were called the Intolerable Acts, meant to bring the colonies into line. So talk to us about the Tea Party aftermath and those Intolerable Acts.
Yeah, the key thing to think about with, you know, all of the lead up to the Revolution was that, you know, England had, fought the French in the Seven Years' War from 1763 and basically had overextended the British military and didn't really have a way to pay for it. And so Parliament thought that the, you know, Americans should pay for it. They passed the Stamp Act in 1765. Then they had, all sorts of other taxes, which eventually led to the Boston Tea Party. But it was really the overbearing of tax collections and not giving representation in Parliament. So no taxation without representation. We even hear that today.
Sure.
It was one of the key ideas that brought about the events that led to the war.
Right. The four main coercive acts were they closed the Boston port. There's the Massachusetts Government Act, and that revoked the colony's charter, replacing elected officials with royal appointees. They limited town meetings and gave the appointed governor greater control. Talked about that in a second here. The Administration of Justice Act, and that allowed British officials to be yanked out of America and sent off to England to be tried. And that was seen as protecting British misconduct. And then there was, of course, the Onerous Quartering Act that required colonists to house and supply British troops, even in their private homes. So
all of these things are spelled out so well in the Declaration of Independence about, having people, having foreign troops live in your home, confiscation of your goods, the lack of a right to assemble, to have free speech, all of these things, which you can read in our Declaration, which, of course, we do every 4th of July. We read it, reminds us of all these basic freedoms and how the British really brought this on by being very hard on the colonial people.
Yes. I had mentioned that the existing governor, Thomas Hutchinson, who was primarily political and administrative, he was replaced by a military governor, and that was General Gage. And that happened in May of 1774. So let's talk a little bit about him. He was the second son of a British nobleman, a Viscount. And because he's the second son, he didn't stand to inherit, so he ended up in the army. He made his first appearance in the colonies during the French and Indian War and met a young 22-year-old lieutenant colonel by the name of George Washington at the Battle of Monongahela. That's about 10 miles east of Pittsburgh there. So maybe start there, that battle, because it really put both Gage and Washington on their respective career paths.
Yeah, they were. They were fighting the French, and of course, you know, it was all really done for control of the Ohio Valley. Washington and Braddock had marched, you know, into the Ohio Valley. And, you know, basically Gage was the British commander. So they all knew each other. And Gage, in fact, you know, married a woman from New Jersey, basically stayed in the States after the, you know, French and Indian War, and basically knew many of these people. So they were all known to each other. Some would say Gage got recalled eventually by the British because they didn't think he was hard enough on the colonials. So anyway, but they knew Washington, and Washington did not do a great job as a general in the French and Indian War. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, thought that he and Braddock really kind of messed up that campaign, and they came back. So the British military thought that George Washington was second rate and that the colonials didn't have the discipline really to act as a formidable army.
So you had mentioned that Washington took some of the blame. As I understand it, Gage also got some of the blame for that because they blamed it on his poor tactics.
Right. So the tactics were not good. And of course, there was a massacre that they were involved with where Jumonville was a French officer and had troops, you know, in that campaign that Washington was thought to have massacred. And so there was just a lot of missteps with Braddock. But the idea was that as General Gage, but that he actually knew the colonials pretty well.
Yeah.
And that would become important as they got to the siege of Boston in 1774.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We're going to continue this discussion as we look back at the year 1775, the year leading up to the Declaration of Independence. We're doing that with Greg Leo. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's our 15th annual 4th of July show, and we're talking today to our usual guest for those, Greg Leo. He's a political consultant for businesses, governments, and individuals. You can find out more about him and the work he does at theleocompany.com. And so, Greg, we've been talking about Thomas Gage there. He was the general that was overseeing Massachusetts at the time of Lexington and Concord. Before we move on from there, I just want to mention that, you had mentioned that he ended up marrying Margaret Kemble, and she was a kind of an American beauty there, and she was very well connected. Her family was among the elites of both New York and New Jersey at the time. Gage had initially got his position because he was the son of a Viscount, and marrying Margaret, an American upper-class beauty, and her social connections just bolstered his. And I think those connections really served him well, getting promotions when probably he should not have. Gage did not have an exactly spectacular military career in the field. In fact, after Monongahela, his next campaign was rather disastrous. He recruited 16,000 men, but then they got routed by only 4,000 French troops. And maybe that's fortunate because somebody more competent in that first year in 1775 might have had very different results dealing with the American Patriots. But I really see those two generals as kind of a America versus England in a nutshell. Gage got his promotions and his position because of his connections and his inherited nobility versus Washington, who, like Gage, married well, an upper-class wife. But in his military career, he earned his way up the ranks. And not just the generals, I think that's really the difference between America and England at the time.
I think the leaders are very emblematic of the times. I mean, Gage was upper-class, married, you know, the top tier of American society, and basically, Washington, even though he was probably the most wealthy man in the colonies, had worked his way up. He had been a surveyor, he had cleared land, and he married Martha Custis, of course, who was one of the richest women in America. So they were both upper class, but one being British, one being American, one that kind of came up through society and the other who was, you know, like born to the manor. I think that made a big difference, actually, in the way that they campaigned and as they fought.
Yeah. Well, let's fast forward to after the Boston Tea Party. Gage had missed that because he was he'd taken his family for a trip back to England. But while there, he got appointed as governor of Massachusetts. And so when he came back, along with those 4,000 troops that were dispatched, his main job was to bring the colony back into submission. And as I understand it, he even helped draft the Intolerable Acts. How would you describe his reign, so to speak? I suppose the colonists didn't call them the Intolerable Acts because he was kind of benevolent and went easy on everybody.
No, and the whole idea of taking it out, you remember, this is all about tax collection and the tax on tea and paper and paint and glass and all the many things that the Townsend duties put in place were all levied without any say. And so, of course, Americans being who we are, you know, figured out a way to smuggle and to get them in without the tax. But the protest of dumping the tea in the harbor was the flashpoint, and Boston was the epicenter of this revolt. And so they basically wanted to show the people in Boston that they could not continue the protest these kind of revenue items. They burnt the tax collector's house, and they, you know, I think tarred and feathered them at one point. The point is that that all led to increasing violence and eventually, you know, caused the events that, you know, led to Lexington and Concord.
Right. Well, speaking of leading up to Lexington and Concord, I didn't realize that there was a couple of predecessors before Lexington and Concord. And one of which was the Somerville event. It became known as the Powder House Alarm. And Somerville is a village at the time. It's about 4 miles northwest of Boston and happened on September 1st, 1774, so about 7 months before Lexington and Concord. But unlike those battles, no shots were fired. I had not heard of Somerville. I had not heard of Somerville. Did you know much about that? And what can you tell us about it?
I do a little because, you know, of course, I went to graduate school at Harvard. And so Somerville is really a place where a lot of Harvard students live today. But it's really kind of a suburb, and it's on the same road that goes out to Lexington and Concord. And so I think what they had was they had a storehouse there for powder. Mm-hmm. They did have a few pieces of ordnance, but they had muskets and that kind of thing. Knowing that the British would try to suppress that, they drove them out. And the colonials basically took the powder and all of the means of revolt and took it to Lexington and Concord to protect it. So then the idea that Gage wanted to make sure that they didn't have the means of waging war. They knew it was kind of getting down to blows, and that's why they sent that raid out to get the munitions that the colonials had in Lexington and Concord.
Yeah, as I understand it, the Boston troops at Somerville, they had moved out from Boston to avoid detection by boats. The British troops did end up confiscating about 250 half barrels of gunpowder. That was about 12,500 pounds. And brought them back to Boston. And then they also end up seizing two small brass cannons from nearby Cambridge. And
that's right.
And it nearly came to blows the next day. You know, the word had gone out. There was some suspicion that some of the colonists had been killed. And so, of course, that got people really wound up. And there were some estimates that between 20 and 30,000 militiamen marched on Cambridge to confront the British. But fortunately, when they got there, cooler heads ended up prevailing. Joseph Warren negotiated a truce with talked with the British authorities and made sure that nobody had actually been killed. That was just rumor. And so the crowd dispersed without any shots being fired. But it really did, in many ways, set the stage for Lexington and Concord. Mm-hmm. Without the lessons from Somerville, the British very well could have beaten the Patriots to Concord and seized the weapons there. Because the British were able to confiscate the arms and supplies they did at Somerville, the Americans realized they had to improve their communication network and especially their early warning system, which was still in its early days.
Exactly. And people knew that there was an increasing conflict here and that it was going to come to blows because of the acts of coercion and all of the things that the British government was trying to do to suppress free assembly and freedom of speech. And so the idea of letting the Minutemen know, the Minutemen being the patriots who were ready to rise to the defense, this was a time when everybody had a musket. A lot of their meat was provided with muskets. They lived on essentially the edge of the forest, and they were long well organized against Indian attacks. So it was not a new thing for the farmers in that part of Massachusetts to be able to rise to mutual defense.
Yeah. Okay. The lanterns in the North Church, Paul Revere's and Dawes's midnight ride happened even though the Concord expedition to seize arms and to arrest Patriot leaders was supposed to be a secret mission. So who leaked it? Some historians think they may have the answer. That's coming up as our 4th of July show continues with Greg Leo. And welcome back. We're talking about the 4th of July, our annual 4th of July show. But before that, there was a whole year, 1775, that led up to that. And we're talking about the battles of Lexington, Concord, and some other events of that year that led to the July 4th signing of the Declaration of Independence. And we're doing that with Greg Leo. He's our usual guest for these. He's an amateur historian and member of the Sons of American Revolution. And George, I've never done that in 15 years. I must have Washington still on my mind. Greg, anyone can join that as long as they have an ancestor that served in the Revolution, right?
Yeah, we document our connection to our ancestor who fought in the Revolutionary War. Luckily, I had that lineage all set up by my relatives in the 1930s. So I just had to connect from the 1930s to today. But my relative was Ephraim Hayward, and he fought at Yorktown and was one of the Connecticut Volunteers. So, you know, it's great to be able to trace your lineage back to the people who were actually there and fought for our freedom.
Yes. Well, it is cool. I've got two relatives for sure that I know served. There's a couple of others, kind of indirect ones that were like uncles or brothers, that kind of thing. So I have not joined that yet, but I really ought to one of these days. So we were talking about the predecessor to Lexington and Concord, the event there at Somerville. There was a couple of other weapon seizures, actually on both sides. December 1774 at Fort William and Mary in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Patriots had seized some gunpowder and cannons, and no shots were fired there either. In February 26, so this is just 2 months before Lexington and Concord, Gage sent troops to Salem, Massachusetts to seize cannons and munitions reportedly stored there. Local militiamen alerted in advance. Again, there's the effect of that early warning system that they had. They raised the drawbridge to block the British advance and hid the supplies. And after a tense standoff, the British withdrew. And there's another couple of other ones. But really, all of this was to seize weapons. And I think it's important here, you know, we need to not forget that the right to bear arms was established law. It was established in response to King James II, a century before, a Catholic king who had confiscated guns from Protestants while allowing Catholics to be armed. And then in the Bill of Rights, 1689, it established the right of all Englishmen to arm themselves. It restored the rights of Protestants and allowed the rights of Catholics to continue. But here we are in 1774 and 1775, the king was busily disarming his own citizens. I assume very much like the days of James II, arms were only being taken from disfavored subjects and not taken from loyalists. So basically the same
That's
effects
right.
and just taking the religious side of things out.
It was really a way to suppress rebellion and really speech. And so, you know, our freedoms, we have to fight for our freedoms, and to be able to, you know, every man has a musket, you know, that you have a community cannon, that you're able to organize a militia, well-armed militia, that people have the right to bear arms, all come out of this situation where the totalitarian state was trying to take away the guns, take away your speech, take away your ability, you know, to assemble, put people in, you know, put military people in your homes, take your goods, confiscate your goods, give you high taxes, and you didn't get any representation in Parliament. So, yes, many of the things in the Declaration are exactly the intolerable acts of the king and the Parliament.
Yeah, you can absolutely see why they included that once you start understanding the predecessors to that. So April 14th, 1775, Gage received orders from Britain saying, you guys need to do something over there, rather strongly worded, as I understand.
Yep.
So he settled on Concord. And what was or rumored to be being stored there at Concord? And then also, why did he settle on Lexington?
Well, two things, really. First of all, a lot of the ringleaders of what they considered the revolt were out there. It wasn't just going for the guns and the cannon and the munitions that had been at Somerville, but they were also looking for Warren, you know, for John Adams, for the other people who were the leaders. They were hoping to decapitate the movement by going in and, you know, arresting and imprisoning the leaders, what they call the rabble-rousers of the revolution. And so they were actually going to Concord because they heard that those folks were there as well as the guns. And so it wasn't just the guns, but also the leadership. And so the idea was a raid that, you know, that Gage would order a raid to go out there, confiscate the munitions, arrest the ringleaders, and just shut down this thing. Gage was getting a lot of pressure from London to deal with it.
Yes.
And to make it stop.
Yes.
So.
And to do so, I mean, with the iron fist, basically. So on April 18th, he had settled on Concord. And so this is the day before April 19th, the fateful day. He wrote the orders to Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith. And we actually have a copy of his orders. He had made out a whole bunch of crossouts and everything. Was having trouble trying to find the right words, I guess. Probably because he knew how momentous this was, because things were definitely going to come to a head after this, especially if they end up arresting Patriot leaders there in Lexington.
In his order, he also said, don't pillage.
Yes.
You know, don't pillage and don't try not to stir up the population too much. What he knew was that he would create more conflict and more martyrs if they, you know, they pillaged and they stole as they went through. So there was a call for discipline. I think that was partly because he understood Americans and that this is a very sensitive situation. But on the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is still alive who remembers that famous day and year. And we all know the poem of the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. And a lot of that is exactly what happened. They knew something was up. So Mark, how did they know?
Yeah.
And
well,
this is a great story.
Yeah. Well, since you bring it up, let's go there. There is speculation by some historians that they think they know who leaked it. And that paragraph that you pointed out about the not pillaging, that may be one of the clues, because that's actually in the final draft. It was not in the earlier drafts. And some people consider that to be the influences of his wife on that, because she was American born. And so she certainly had some real sympathies. In fact, a lot of people knew that she had real sympathies for the Patriots. Yeah. In the order, he wrote to Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith and said, it shall be carried out, quote, with the utmost expedition and secrecy, except some spy learned about it and leaked it to the colonist spy network. So a lot of people think it may have been Gage's own wife, Margaret Kemble. What do you know about that?
Well, that Dr. Warren, who is a colonial leader, really had a network of people. And you think about how doctors will connect throughout communities. But Warren had tea the day before with Mrs. Gage. And there is some speculation that she actually said, yeah, they're going to be moving soon to go out to Lexington and Concord to try to scoop up the leaders and the munitions that suppress the revolution. So there's a thought in history that she actually let him know so that Paul Revere and, you know, the other writer whose name I'm forgetting right now actually were pre-positioned, because they said, we think they're going to go one if by land, two if by sea. How would they be that organized to know which way they're going to come? Are they going to come across by ship to Charleston, or are they going to come up the neck, you know, go up through the Boston neck and then up the road? And sure enough, they had it dialed in. And when they saw, you know, the ships were leaving from Charleston, they said this, they're coming by sea. Then and Dawes, I mean, this is his name, Dawes and, you know, Revere were able then to go, you know, spread through every Middlesex village and farm. So that was, I think, just really good intelligence gathering and knowing what the intentions of the British were and where they were coming. And those two things were critically important.
Yeah, and it is speculative. We don't know for sure, but there are a lot of things that would point to the fact that she was the spy with the loose lips. We'll continue after this break here to look at Margaret Kemble, the wife of General Gage, who may have tipped off the Patriots. We're doing that with Greg Leo. Hey.
And welcome back. This is our annual 4th of July show. We're talking with Greg Leo. He's the government and public affairs consultant to governments, tribes, corporations, and individuals. If you need help appealing to the better nature of somebody in government, get in touch with Greg. You can do so at The Leo Company. Make sure you put the in there, theleocompany.com. And so, Greg, going on to that last break there, we had been talking about Margaret Kemble and the fact that she, well, there's rumors that she may have been the spy that leaked the details of where the British were going that fateful night heading out to Concord.
Also she had read her husband's papers, and they had met the day before, you know, with Warren. Warren was, of course, the spy master, and so it was natural to think that they would be out to suppress this kind of growing revolt to try to get, you know, the people. And so the idea that she may have said something to Warren never really been documented. It's historical speculation, and maybe that's good, but we should have a warm spot in our heart for her, because if, in fact, she did help Warren understand that was the key to the whole situation. Yes. That turned out so well for our country.
Yeah, well, it could have been disastrous if they had not been able to get there and save those weapons, the Patriots, I mean, get there in time to save the weapons. And again, it was that spy network and also the communications network. So much of what they had been working on for the last year is now coming to fruition. It is speculation there about Margaret Kemble being the spy. Nothing in the more than 23,000 documents of the Gage collection outs her as a spy, so it's kind of rumor. It would be awfully cool. It certainly makes a good story, whether or not she did. There are some other people. Yeah, well, see, that was where I was going with that. There are some other people that are also rumored to have leaked it, but yeah, what is I think rather telling is that after Concord, Gage then sent her off to England in the summer of 1775, and you know, but apparently she was pregnant at the time, so that could have been it as well. But
yeah,
it is rather suspicious
that. The wounded and the widows were all sent back, and she lived for another 30 some odd years in London.
Yeah.
And thank goodness nobody ever really said for sure, because it probably would have meant a death sentence for her. So.
Undoubtedly. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that spy network and the communications network, because that's what Revere was part of. There's got to be a difficult time to be living because they had spies and informants on both sides. But you're in a situation where, as you just alluded to with Margaret Kemble, I mean, if somebody had found out, she could have been killed. And so
absolutely
that would have been, I mean, I can't imagine living in that time period where you're constantly surrounded by all these spies and informants. You don't know who you're talking to, could be end up being a spy for the other side. I can't imagine the stress of that.
Well, and you think about it in terms of the sociology, there were so few revolutionaries that they think less than 10% of the population was actually engaged in trying to fight for our freedoms, that there were neighbors who were Tories. There were people, a lot of people, probably half the people who just didn't care. And so if you're in a society where some, you know, people have divided loyalties, some people are loyalists, some people believe in freedom and are, you know, ready to fight for it, but nobody knows for sure who you are. And so you have to be so careful. But the idea that you would have a network of people that would feed the Patriots the information in Boston in that supercharged environment at that time is not surprising.
Yeah, absolutely. So as far as Revere is concerned, there was, of course, another writer there, Dawes, as well. Revere gets a lot of the credit, I think, because there's several books about him and of course, the poem, too, that kind of helped his fame. Fun little fact, though, they did not say the British are coming. The British are coming, and said they were saying the regulars are coming. The regulars are coming, because almost everyone back then considered themselves to be British. So talk to us about
they were all British, and so it would be like, well, yeah, we're British, we're here. So I mean, yeah.
You know, a little confusion
the regular
there.
Troops or the lobster backs or the, you know, the ones who were dressed in red, not the irregular troops or the militia, or the ones that would be dressed in blue or probably even just the regular farm gear. But it was the farmers that marshaled out, came out, and learned that they were coming, and then they just lined the road. So I want to talk a bit about Concord, because about Lexington, and about that's really where it happened. And mm-hmm. You can go there today to the green in Lexington and see these guys were only standing maybe 30 feet apart. They had muskets with big 50 caliber musket balls that would absolutely kill or maim you. And they had the courage to stand up against these regular troops, these British regulars who had there were well-seasoned troops who had fought, you know, the French and were, pretty effective. So the idea that, you know, the farmers would gather up, you know, rally around an elected captain, stand in a line on an open green and face off with the British military is an amazing thing. Mm. And so hats off to the Minutemen. They walked the walk that made our freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. So backing up a little bit to Revere's ride, he nearly got caught by two British patrolling on horseback outside of Cambridge. One gave chase, but Revere backtracked and managed to get away. After making it to Lexington and spreading the alarm there, he and Dawes continued on to Concord, and a third rider, Prescott, joined them a little outside of Lexington. But then, before they could reach Concord, all three of them were stopped by a British patrol. The other two managed to escape, but Revere was held for a bit, questioned, and then let go, except they took his horse. He had to walk back to Lexington and arrived about dawn, just in time to witness the last part of the battle on the Lexington Green. That could have been a very short trip if those patrols had caught him outside of Boston.
Yeah, they wouldn't have been able to spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm.
Well, and I know that Hancock and Sam Adams were both hiding out there. I think in it was a public house that Hancock's family owned. So they were able to get out.
That inn is still there. You can go there today. And I did. I had lunch there. And it's really cool green. You see the statue that's there of the Minuteman, which of course is famous and one of our great historic symbols. And it's Lexington is where it happened. And of course, nobody knows who fired the first shot.
Right.
It may have been a misfire, you know, but everybody was kind of staring each other down. Somebody's musket went off and then there was volley after volley and they got bloodier from there.
Yeah. Well, as far as Lexington, it was one of the towns between Boston and Concord, Concord being their ultimate destination. When the Brits arrived, John Hancock and Sam Adams had already escaped after Revere's and Dawes' warning. So talk to us about the moment when the British first arrived there in Lexington. There were 700 British regulars in their full military gear and rifles that had marched from Boston. And if I remember correctly, there were only 70 American patriots facing off against them. Do I have my numbers correct?
Because
that would
sure
take a lot of guts to stand there staring off against 10 to 1.
I'm not sure the exact number, but I do want to say the National Park Service has an excellent interpretive site for the Minuteman National Monument that probably has that information. But it was enough that it was an overwhelming British force, but there were enough American, colonial patriots there to stand up. So I'm going to guess a couple hundred were there at Lexington. And more kept coming.
Yeah.
As the word got out, then throughout the countryside, people would grab their muskets and rise to the occasion.
Well, it at least slowed the British down before getting to Concord, and we'll deal with Concord next. Everyone stay with us. More with Greg Leo. When he's not busy trying to protect Oregonians from the Oregon legislature, Greg Leo is an avid historian, and he's our guest for all of these July 4th shows. And we're talking today about the battles of Lexington and Concord and the momentous year of 1775 that led up to the signing of the Declaration in 1776. Greg, during the break there, you were talking about how really awe-inspiring it is that the militia that were facing off against trained British troops, these were, this was the top army in the entire world at the time. And yet these are the militia on the American side. These are people from all walks of life.
They were all people from the village. They were farm boys. They were, older people. They were people of all ages really came forward. And that was the thing about your freedom. Everybody in the community knew that this mattered and they stepped up. And people from all over the countryside then would come into the Lexington to the Green. And that's where they got organized and lined up along the road for the famous retreat. But anyway, the idea was that everybody would turn out, and this was just the way people were then, and they all would step up. And so on that green that day was not a good scene for the Americans. It was pretty bloody. A number were killed. And then they would retreat back up the road towards Concord. And the British then would come through Lexington, move up the road to Concord, and fight the second battle at Concord Bridge. And Concord Bridge is there today. You can go there, walk across the bridge. It's really like a funnel. And you can just see how the concentrated fire of, you know, these farmers, excellent marksmen there at Concord, with the British coming across the bridge, just started the rout that that was just disastrous for the British Army.
Yeah. So when the British arrived in Concord about 8 a.m., thanks to the warning from Dawes and Prescott in the pre-dawn hours, most of those arms and munitions had already been moved out. And I think there was at least four cannon, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And so it wasn't just a bunch of muskets and some shot and some gunpowder. It was some pretty heavy munitions that they were after. They did find some. They weren't able to get everything out. But how long did that battle at Concord last? I mean, was that fairly engaged, really, or was it just pretty quick and everybody had to scatter?
It took a couple hours. I mean, the whole thing was about a 24-hour operation from the time they landed at Charleston to the time they, you know, the bedraggled British troops came back in. But this was a disastrous raid because along the road, you know, they just came out of the woods and all of the farmers would show up. And so,
yes.
But at Concord, that was the real turning point because in theory, that's where they could have scooped up the leaders and also the munitions. And it really was the point at which the rout started. And the, you know, the British then would march back and famously march down the middle of the road with the American marksmen behind the trees and rocks, you know, behind the rock walls that lined that New England countryside, and were excellent shots and basically just wreaked havoc on the British as they marched down the road.
Yeah. And of course, as you mentioned, the whole affair took 24 hours. And so they had the long march there. They're under fire at first at Lexington and then again at Concord. And then as they're trying to retreat, they are vastly outnumbered. I mean, because by then you have farmers coming from miles around, all sorts of people, you know, that lived in those villages. They're all joining the fight. And so they were harassed the entire way back through Lexington and all the way back to Boston. I know that they had some kind of reinforcements coming in because word had started to go back to Boston at that point that, hey, we're taking a lot of fire here. And so they did get some reinforcements that allowed the first set of troops to get some, you know, kind of catch their breath, basically. But yeah, what a disastrous day for the British.
Well, and the word got out, and then all along the eastern seaboard, literally thousands of volunteers converged on Cambridge. And so they heard about the Minutemen. They heard about, you know, how that raid had turned into a full-fledged battle between the colonials and the British. And so there at the kind of the commons in Cambridge, all of these thousands of people from along the whole eastern coast converged. And George Washington then showed up and organized the American Army. So we just celebrated the 250th anniversary of the United States Army. And that is where it was born, on the green there at Cambridge, where all of the folks that came out because of the, you know, Minutemen and what happened at Lexington and Concord came forward.
Well, as far as the aftermath of Lexington and Concord, we'll finish up with that in our next segment. But when the British troops finally straggled back into Boston, by the time they arrived, they'd had more than 70 killed and close to 200 wounded and another 50 or so either missing or captured. I'm trying to put myself in the head of Thomas Gage there as he is taking assessment of his troops that barely made it back. He's got to write that letter to the king and explain all of this.
He had to be thinking, how did this go so wrong?
Yes.
And how did they know I was coming? How did they get organized in the way? And it was all the idea that, you know, that the colonials really kind of understood what the objective was, what the route of march was going to be, you know, what their plan was. And without the pre-intelligence to do that, it could have been a complete rout. If they had maintained the element of surprise, likely they would have got the munitions and the leaders, and they would have put back the revolution. But as it turned out, after everyone massed there at Cambridge and the Continental Army started to get organized, the siege of Boston was organized, and the British were almost pushed out of Boston almost immediately. And of course, that led to the Battle of Breed's Hill, which is really the Battle of Bunker Hill, which we won't talk about today. But the idea was that had this gone differently without good intelligence, it would have been a whole different outcome.
Yes, absolutely. All right, we're going to wrap things up with Greg Leo talking about the 4th of July and the year leading up to that momentous signing. Stay with us. And welcome back in our final segment now here on our 15th annual 4th of July show. We're talking with Greg Leo. He is a consultant on government and public affairs for tribes, businesses, and individuals. You can check him out at theleocompany.com. We'll link that up on today's show page, which is 15-26. Speaking of which, there are a ton of great resources on that page for you to go through and share. Some really cool ones, too, about Paul Revere, the battlefield, some maps, the myth of Margaret Kemble, even the guy some suspect may have taken that shot heard around the world, and lots of others. And Greg, I'd like to talk about the aftermath of Lexington and Concord, one of which was as a result of this battle, Lord Dunmore's proclamation. Talk to our audience about that.
Well, the British governor of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, issued a proclamation offering freedom to any slave of the rebellious American colonies if they would come over and enter the British lines. So throughout the course of the war, tens of thousands of African Americans would seek their freedom by going to the British. This absolutely made the Southern states angry. It's the same issue that we fought later on, the Civil War, over. But the idea was that states that otherwise would not have maybe stepped up here, like South Carolina, Georgia, other places, this absolutely poured gasoline on the fire. So it went from kind of an intense insurrection in Massachusetts to being across the entire colonies through Lord Dunmore. And then the British tried to take the Carolinas, were eventually defeated there at Moore's Creek. And so the war spread. The committees of correspondence would spread the news throughout the colonies. Many came to Boston. There was a siege of Boston, which eventually ended up in the Battle of Bunker Hill. But the British were essentially driven from Boston because of this. So the catalytic thing that happened, though, was what happened at Lexington and Concord, and the fact that it spread. The war for the revolution now was well underway. Americans had stood up to the biggest army and the best army in the world, and they showed that they had the fighting prowess as just citizen soldiers to stand up for their freedom.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think also what 1775 really did was it really showed the mental and emotional change from British subjects to American patriots. And I think it kind of is encapsulated in two ways. One, if Margaret Kemble was the spy that tipped off the patriots, and, you know, for the sake of discussion, let's just assume she was, you can really see that how she kind of encapsulates that too, where she is seeing herself less and less as a British subject and instead as an American, as a patriot. And this is less the British colony and instead it's America. And it's not the kings. And I think it's the same is very true for the militia on the field that day at Lexington and Concord. I'm sure some of them were probably veterans of the French and Indian War there. And starting with the French and Indian War, and now here at the Greens at Lexington and Concord, they're willing to die for their land, their country. You know, it's one thing to say you want to be free. It's another to have that change of mindset to now be willing to sacrifice everything for it, that it is better to die standing free than to die on your knees as a subject. I mean, that's a huge mental shift.
This idea of, well, what is America? It's not about geography. It's not about, you know, who your ruler is. It's really about how you look at your freedom. And, you know, Margaret looked at her freedom the way that the rest of the Americans of the time did. Their freedom was precious, and they wanted to fight for it. They needed to be able to be an independent people who were well-recognized and had the political rights of other British people. So no taxation without representation becomes revolt because, you know, tyrants try to suppress free speech, take away guns, quarter troops, etc. And so they just pour gasoline on the fire. And, you know, if they had just worked it out, you know, eventually there was a olive branch that we sent over that was rebuffed with more troops, and it just accelerated the conflict.
Well, yes. And in fact, I thought that same thing as I was prepping for the show, is that if they had just taken a less heavy-handed approach with the colonists, things probably would have turned out very differently. You know, yes, we mentioned earlier about what became the Second Amendment, this notion that you know, it's a God-given right that you should be able to defend yourself, whether you're a Catholic or a Protestant or anything. I mean, this isn't a fundamental right. And so I think all of this, you can just really see how it just paves that way leading up to the Declaration of Independence. But again, if the Crown had just handled things very differently, rather than trying to subjugate everybody, it could have been very different. And, you know, I think eventually it would have happened, but I don't know that winning our freedom peacefully would have meant nearly so much if we had not fought for it and put everything on the line. Freedom is worth fighting for. It's worth dying for.
It's about the rights of man and all of these ideas of the Enlightenment about individual rights and freedoms. And so out of that comes the way we Americans think about our government, self-government, our own rights, our, you know, our Bill of Rights, all of the things that are so well articulated in the Declaration and then confirmed in our Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely. Greg, we only have about a minute and change here. Real quick, as far as Bunker Hill is concerned, because you had mentioned that after Lexington and Concord, they began to start making preparations to, because this is in June, so roughly 2 months later, they had tried to siege Boston. So talk to us a little bit about that attempted siege and how, even though we lost and had to withdraw, it was still its own kind of victory.
Well, the inexperienced colonial troops held off these hardened British veterans for more than 2 hours on Breed's Hill, which is the first of two hills that are just kind of north of Charleston. And so basically, there was artillery that the colonials were able to get that were shelling the British ships. And so they wanted to stop, Gage wanted to stop that. So he sent the British troops up Breed's Hill, which was a tactical victory by the British, but at high cost. Eventually, forcing the British, you know, up, they were trying to get the higher ground of the second hill, which is actually Bunker Hill. And the Patriots showed them that they were not intimidated by long lines of red-coated infantry. Of the 2,000 British seeing action, more than 1,000, half of the troops, half of the British, were killed or wounded in the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Yeah.
And that told the Americans, we have the chops to be able to fight for our freedom.
Yes, absolutely. Again, there's that mind shift. We can do this. And, you know, they only had to back down because they simply ran out of ammunition. If only they'd had the arms and ammunition that had been stolen there at Somerville, that could have turned out very differently as well. Greg, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to wish you the happiest of 4th of Julys.
Thank you, and celebrate your freedom, everyone. Enjoy those rights that those patriots died for.
Greg is absolutely right. If we don't enjoy and use the freedoms our founders fought and sacrificed for, then we don't deserve them. Our freedoms are God-given, but you have to fight for them. And if we don't or won't stand up to defend our freedoms, then we have squandered their victory and our heritage. Freedom and liberty are best learned by living examples. And that includes, like we saw all too recently, when our own governments overstep and trample on our hard-won freedoms. Let your children and grandchildren see you willing to take a stand, so they will pick up the torch of liberty and carry on the fight from generations past. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.